Please silence all electronic devices.
I'm sorry, folks. I don't trust them. And our folks don't trust them.
There is a great deal of overreaction from those who are criticizing this legislation. They will see me in court. You know, if the General Assembly were really trying to do a power grab, there's a lot of things the General Assembly could do, and we weren't.
And they don't have a very good track record there.
Any further discussion or debate?
From the Legislative Press Dungeon on 16 West Jones Street in downtown Raleigh, this is the WUNC Politics Podcast. I'm Jeff Tiberi. It is Thursday, July 11th, 2019. As always, pleased to have you along for this edition of the pod as we chat about a hurry-up and wait week at the North Carolina General Assembly. And, spoiler alert, we're still waiting for a two-year spending plan. The governor would like Medicaid expansion. Legislative leaders would like Democrats, or enough Democrats, to defect from the party so that they can override the governor's budget veto and head home. But at the moment, no one is getting what they want. It was a week of much arm-twisting, appropriation pitching, and even some tears, or so we've been told from multiple sources. Here to discuss a week of not really all that much at all is Robert Reeves, Democrat from Chatham County, a deputy Democratic leader in the North Carolina House. Representative Reeves, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Jeff. I'm glad to be here.
Did you have any fun this week?
Not a bit.
I want to talk about, do you want to expound on that or should I just move on? Because that's an honest answer and I think that probably covers it.
Yeah, I think that probably covers
it. Okay. I want to talk about some of the tougher conversations that you had with some of your colleagues. If you want to name names, that's of course great and interesting. But if you'd rather just talk about the substance of those conversations, I think that as we talk about this budget, and just quick reminder, 30 seconds, and I just said it there, legislative budget passed. Vetoed by the governor for the third consecutive year. But for the first time in Cooper's tenure, there aren't enough Republican votes on a party line vote to override him and be done with this conversation. So we're at this impasse. So the Republicans are looking for some Democrats to vote to override the governor's veto. And they don't have enough Democrats as of right now, as we record this on a Thursday afternoon. I think sometimes people forget that it's not necessarily that easy to stick with your party on certain things, this being one of them. And there are a number of Democrats in rural districts with constituencies that, if we're being honest, are not doing particularly well economically. It looks a lot different than Wake and Mecklenburg County than it does in, say, parts of Cumberland and Robeson County and the northeast sections of the state. So there are Democrats that have been thinking, and you are not one of them, just to be clear, but there are Democrats who have been thinking about voting to override the governor's veto. What kinds of conversations have you had with some of your colleagues, and what is it like for them, through your eyes, through your lens, as they try to wrestle with sticking with the party and also doing what might be most beneficial for their constituencies and their districts?
Well, Jeff, I think the big problem that you see, and it's really interesting, because I think the conversations that you would have are conversations that are consistent no matter who you're talking with. And what it ultimately comes down to is the bird in the hand. And what happens with some people at times is they look and they say, these are the things that I know right now will happen if I just do X, Y, Z. And their concern is none of us know what will happen if the veto is sustained, because that's brand new territory, as you said. We've actually not been in this place in North Carolina history, if you're being frank, because what you've got is that I think the last time we were close to this is when Governor Perdue was still in office.
Right.
And you had split chambers and things of that sort. But right now, this is the first time that we've had this type of dominance by the Republican Party over this last 10 years. And suddenly all of that that's happened in the last 9 years has come to a stop. And people have to make real decisions. And so that's what the problem is that more people are in a situation where they're thinking, these are things that I know I can get, as opposed to things that, in theory, I should be able to get if we're able to pass a better budget.
How would you describe some of your Democratic colleagues this week? Are they in a point of incredible stress, frustration, fear?
Frustration. I think it's frustration throughout, because the other thing that you'll notice, we've got 18 new Democrats. And what's been consistent throughout those Democrats is we've actually got a different group of people that have come in. Most of these folks that have come in are parents of young children. They're still working 40-hour jobs and things of that sort. And so they're missing family time. They're missing work time. And what's different than the normal schedule is that you have to be there every second. As you saw two times this week, Representative Jackson has stood up and asked for some certainty as to when the veto vote would be so that people could do something as simple as go to the bathroom. And that request was denied. And it's kind of hard when you're coming from our side to justify that, because these are, again, this is why it's so different than it's been for the last 100 years, mm-hmm. because there were common courtesies that just always stood.
Right.
You know, if people were going through health crises, if people were having issues, there were just things that were done to make way for that. And so that's been difficult on these because, again, they've got real lives outside of this place that they want to get back to. And
that cuts across lines.
Yes,
right?
That works for on both sides, because I think if you look at the Republicans that just came in on the freshman side, they're in the same situation because they haven't been through this. Like, a lot of us knew kind of what was getting ready to happen that have been here for a little while. So it's really a lot of frustration on their side.
Somebody who will just remain nameless and not a lawmaker, a staff member said to me recently, and this has been echoed by other people, but a staff member said explicitly to me recently that you got a, and this was the way he described it, he said, you know, you got a lot of old white man animosity building up, and it's built up over years. And as we think about the party player, the most powerful players within these conversations, they are older white men. But his point was that's one of the biggest hurdles that people are going to have to work through as it comes to eventually making some sort of sacrifice or some sort of major concession here. I want to play a cut for you, of you. This is something that you said on the floor yesterday.
If we're going to spend the next 6-7 months deciding on who blinked first, who did what wrong first, who talked about my shoes the first time, you're right, we're never going to get anywhere. So let's just do this. Everybody's wrong. Everybody should have done it differently. Let's start tomorrow and get this done, and then we can get out of here at a decent time, maybe even have some summer left. But please don't tell me that we're going to spend the next 6 months talking about we're not talking to each other now because we didn't talk to each other the right way a couple of months ago.
That's Robert Reeves, our guest here on the WONC Politics Podcast, on the floor of the North Carolina House yesterday. So I thought of what I mentioned that staffer saying to me recently when I heard that clip from you. But I want you to, what pushed you to say that? There's clearly a lot of, you addressed it there, but why did you deliver that speech yesterday?
Well, I did, Jeff, and it was funny because I actually was not intending to speak because, you know, that budget bill was actually, that part of it was a pretty benign part that everybody agreed on, passed unanimously. But it really came from listening to the responses to Darren Jackson. And I think Darren's words were pretty clear. And I think if you know Darren Jackson, Darren's one of the easiest people in this building to deal with. And so to hear some of those attacks and some of those discussions was a little frustrating. And I felt that we kind of had to address that part because we're not up here to service our own personal relationships. We're up here to be servants to all the citizens of North Carolina. So if we're making decisions based on the fact that somebody has made us angry or somebody has upset us or somebody has offended us, you're never going to get anything done. You've got to put those things aside, and we've all got to be adults. And so whatever animosity has built up or whatever bother has built up, you've got to get past that to try to make a decision. And personally, I think that probably comes from a lot of my background as an attorney, just some of my life background, that you just can't spend all your life figuring out who to be mad at next.
You also said yesterday, so let's just do this. Everybody's wrong. Everybody should have done it differently. All right, like if that's where the rearview mirror is, who is it incumbent upon moving forward from your perspective? And you are a Democrat, but who is it incumbent upon to take that real significant first step? I get the grandstanding. We have letters going back and forth between legislative leaders and the governor. Mm-hmm. I asked Senator Berger a couple of days ago, I said, have you texted the governor? Have you called him? They have each other's cell phone numbers. There's been no one-to-one contact. So
right.
From your perspective, who needs to put on their big boy pants at this point and make that first step?
Well, Jeff, again, not having been in between any conversations between individuals, what I can tell you is this. According to the discussions that we continue to hear publicly, everybody was a little confused about what the governor might want. I felt like the governor's been clear for the last 5 months, but that's been my opinion. So now a conference report has been released. That conference report represents what the majority party from both chambers have gotten together and believe would represent a good budget. The governor has now given a 400-page document in response. I think that at this point, somebody's got to respond to his counteroffer. I've not seen a legal transaction or a legal negotiation where that doesn't happen. And so to me, sure, they've got to tell him, okay, based on this document that you sent us, this is what we feel.
The issue of Medicaid, I'd love for you to give me a sense of what, obviously you'd like to see clean Medicaid expansion, no work requirement, no premiums.
Exactly.
But what other iterations of Medicaid would you be willing to support?
I'm willing just to sit down and have the conversation. And personally, I think that's where the governor is. We want clean Medicaid expansion, but here's the reality of compromise. The reality of compromise is you're going to have to give something. What I've got to find out is what is it that the other side feels we need to give on so that we can have a real discussion. Here's what's been interesting about the so far budget impasse. The House unequivocally has presented, if you look at the co-sponsors on the Carolina Cares bill and the Medicaid bills and things of that sort, unequivocally, the House has said, we believe in Medicaid expansion, both Republicans and Democrats.
Now, let me push back a little bit. The House hasn't unequivocally said that because they haven't advanced the Carolina Cares bill onto the Senate.
Right. How many co-sponsors were there on the Carolina Cares bill?
Dozens, if I remember correctly. I'm not looking at it.
But no, there was actually 60 plus.
Okay.
So if you've got
a dozen, but yeah, we're supposed to.
But my point is, and so again, that's leadership that's decided not to push that vote. It hadn't come to a House vote. So if you've already got 60 plus people that have signed on, that means that if that bill hits the floor and each of the co-sponsors votes for it, then they've made a statement. And so that's what I mean by that. I agree with you. I mean, that leadership's not pushing it. So if the House agrees that, also at the beginning of the session, the House said we want a construction bond. They just wanted less of a bond than the government. So to me, that's where I'm getting lost on the impasse, because if you've got 60 plus members that want some form of Medicaid expansion, you've got more members that want the school bond, then why aren't we having those discussions? So to answer your original question, mm-hmm, I'm willing to talk about whatever we need to talk about to get Medicaid expansion.
We played a clip of it, and I quoted a little bit more from what you said yesterday on the floor. I think it was roughly 2.5 to 3 minutes. What kind of reaction has there been, if any, from your Democratic colleagues or from the folks across the aisle?
The people who have come to talk to me were very happy, and most of those Democrats, that those terms were expressed, because, again, there are a bunch of new people here who don't understand why we keep talking at each other instead of getting in a room and having a conversation.
It seems to me as though we're not close to any sort of significant conversation, let alone an impactful breakthrough. This is going to go on for weeks, if not months, barring a surprise. That's my read on it. Is that your read on it?
I believe that, but again, because I talk to a lot of people on the ground on both sides, there's a lot of agreement that's there, but I don't know what it's going to take to get all of our leadership together. So to answer your question, yes, if our leadership continues down the path that we've started, it's going to take weeks.
You're not in the Senate. You're not in the majority party. I'm going to ask you this question anyway. One of the things I think I've had a little bit of trouble squaring is, I understand the governor wants to have a conversation about Medicaid, but at the same time, it doesn't seem as though Democrats have a ton of leverage here. It doesn't seem as though the governor has a ton of leverage. What's the long-term strategy as we think about getting Republicans to come back to the table or getting the Republicans to sit down to talk about some form of Medicaid expansion for the hundreds of thousands of North Carolinians in this coverage gap? Because Phil Berger's been pretty clear on this for 6 years. He has no interest in it. It's not as though there's government shutdown. Government's marching on to some extent. It's not marching quite as quickly. But what's the leverage for the governor?
Well, I think leverage is that we don't have a budget go through, and
but that's enough. But we could go on like this for a year and a half,
right? But if you're speaking frankly, there's $377 million worth of pork in there. I would imagine there are people who would like to see some of those monies on those personal projects get a chance to get moved, and so to me, that does give some leverage.
This is a silly question to ask, but I'm going to ask it anyway. On July 11th, as of now, based on the conversations you've had today, you've been at the governor's mansion today, you've been on the House floor today, when do you think we get a budget? It's a silly question.
I personally have made plans to figure out how I'm going to coordinate when my family comes in to visit between Thanksgiving and Christmas, how I'll be seeing them.
Okay. He's on Twitter at Elect Reeves. That's R-E-I-V-E-S. He is a member of the North Carolina House, a Democrat in his fourth term.
Yes.
Like I said, obviously, clearly didn't have that in front of me. We're going to transition. I want to ask you about a trial that begins on Monday. This is a trial in North Carolina State Court. Three judges are going to be presiding over a challenge to legislative maps. The full 170, 120 House maps, 50 state Senate maps. This is a partisan gerrymandering challenge. It comes less than a month after the Supreme Court said the federal courts are not going to touch partisan challenges. So they kick it to state houses and Congress and then state courts, whose job it is to read the state constitution, as I understand it.
Yes.
On one hand, it seems as though this could have a very impactful ruling, could change the boundaries for 2020. And on the other hand, it really might just be another affirmation that partisan gerrymandering can continue in North Carolina,
right,
as it has for a couple hundred years. How are you sizing this trial up?
Well, when I look at it, I think it is an opportunity for the courts. I wouldn't begin to try to posit what they're going to do, but I think our reality is what you've already seen in places like Pennsylvania. And the reality is that if you look at the parties, you look at the activities of parties, and it was interesting with the Supreme Court decision, as you know, there was the North Carolina case, which was a Republican gerrymander,
right,
and then there was the Maryland case, which was a Democratic gerrymander.
Right.
And so it's not something that's exclusive to either party, but I think that we've got to be realistic when we look at this. And what I can't put together in my mind, what I can't reconcile, is how we can any longer make the argument that partisan gerrymandering helps government. And ultimately, to
me, be fair, is anyone making that argument?
Yeah, no, I don't. But my point is, right, so if it's not helpful to government, if it's not something that helps citizens in any way, then your question at some time has got to be, will the court just make the decision that it's got to go just based on that? Because sometimes courts have made those decisions. There have been things throughout our history that have been legal and mm-hmm. that have followed the letter of the law that at some point a court has just said, I'm just not going to let this continue. And I think that's part of what the Pennsylvania court said, because you can make a great legal argument, I'm sure, to keep it in place because it's always been there.
Right.
So,
do you have an example of one of those things you were just thinking of? You're the legal mind here at this countertop. Something that has been consistent with the letter of the law, but the court turned down?
Well, I think, no, not that the court turned down. What I was saying is that the courts have then said, guys, we've got to stop doing
right,
it.
Right, right, right.
Yeah, I mean, for instance, I mean, you look at Brown v. Board of Education, things of that sort. I mean,
sure.
That was
sure.
legal at the time.
Right.
And the court just said, we just can't keep pretending like this is okay. And that was really, to me, what Brown was. I mean, obviously, it was more technical than that, but it just came down to them saying, guys, you can't keep looking me in the face and saying that separate but equal works. And it's the same thing here. You can't keep saying that a partisan gerrymander, because if you look at the, I mean, it was interesting that you used the terms that you did earlier about some of the angst that has been seen with government.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at the parties and you look at the makeups, I struggle to say that a racial gerrymander can't be allowed, but that a partisan gerrymander can. Because if you look at the makeups of the neighborhoods and the peoples that are affected,
they're intertwined. They're woven together.
That's very intertwined. And again, I'm not saying what's right or wrong, but I'm saying that how do you separate those two arguments?
And then in turn, the question that I constantly hear and will chew the fat on with some is, well, what's the standard? What is too far? How do you I mean, I think most people, if we're being honest, agree there's a way to do this that's less partisan, that is more fair. But what is it? How do we make maps more fair? And where, in your opinion, if you have one, where should the line be drawn so we can go, oh, that map, that district, that's too partisan?
Here's what I would say. I've got two bills that I was a primary sponsor on, six altogether I've sponsored, and so I believe in all of those methods. I think if you're looking objectively, what the problem is with gerrymandering right now is the fact that the people who most benefit from those maps are the ones who are drawing those maps. And so any mechanism that keeps people who most benefit from it from being able to influence it works. And so, you know, there are tons of ways. You know, you've got the commission approach. You've got the constitutional approach that just says, look, you've got to stop using party and demographics and things of that sort. But really, you just kind of got to get us out of it, because right now what's going to happen in 2021, if we don't fix this problem, is that you're going to have a lot of people who, you want to talk about some built up angst, but you're going to have a lot of people still here that have spent 10 years in litigation,
right,
making a decision about how these maps ought to be drawn. And I think in and of itself, you almost have an argument to say, 2021, no matter what the court decides, you guys can't make this decision because you're pretty influenced right now about what happened over the last 10 years.
A couple of various and sundry here. Feel free to respond to any of these if you want, but just kind of wrapping up this portion of our conversation. You're going to hear a lot, and when I say you, not you, but you, the listeners, we'll hear a lot about Pennsylvania in the coming weeks. And those, the partisan gerrymandering challenge that was successful there last year, just as a reminder, pertained to congressional maps in that state. And when they were struck down by the state Supreme Court, it did result in more Democrats serving in the U.S. House from Pennsylvania. Challenge here, legislative maps, just for whatever that is worth. And it is important, as you just mentioned, to think about the next round of redistricting, because we're not necessarily right up against it, but we're getting awfully close. And depending on what happens with this trial, there could be a court-ordered redraw of legislative maps for 2020. And that's so important because census, unless the president does something crazy, there's going to be a census next year, and there's going to be a round of redistricting in 2021. And Democrats are obviously trying to take back one or both of the chambers here at the North Carolina legislature. And this is a process that is truly legislatively done in North Carolina. The governor does not have a veto,
right,
as it pertains to redistricting. So any other thoughts on that trial or redistricting before I hit you with a bunch of random ones?
No, the only thing is to say is that I hope that whatever happens with the trial, it happens in a pretty timely fashion. And that way we've got a way to be prepared and to do whatever we got to do.
We've been told 2 or 3 weeks that an appeal to the state Supreme Court is inevitable. And oh, by the way, filing is in less than 5 months. Which leads me to my next question. We'll move to the lightning round here. David Lewis said to me in a casual conversation, I believe last summer, after kind of a day like today, just a long day and a long week in the legislature, he said, I'll tell you. He's like, you know what we should do? We should make the filing period like the 10 to 14 days after session, because we'd really weed out a lot of people who don't want to come back here. If that proposal was put forth, would you support it?
After days like today, it'd be a little tough to turn that one down. But yeah, but I think we should leave it where it is.
We should leave where it is. Late in the year. Okay. All right. Most notable piece of legislation to become law this year in North Carolina.
You got me on that one. There's been so much
there's
that's
been
gone
so
through.
Much.
Yeah.
Okay.
I can't think.
Let me. If you think of one, we can come back to it. Most notable proposal to die this session.
Redistricting.
NBA free agency. The move you were most excited about.
Wow. It was probably, I want to say it was Kawhi going to the LA Clippers.
Yeah.
Just because that was unexpected.
Where did you want him? Were you pulling for him, or were you pulling for the Warriors in the finals?
Oh, no, I was pulling for the Warriors, okay. And I wanted him to go to Lakers because I've been a lifelong Lakers fan.
All right, 23 minutes and we might be done.
But
I grew up outside of Boston. I have little patience.
I wanted him to stay with Toronto just because I loved what he did up there, and that was an amazing story.
Favorite Laker?
Favorite Lakers, Magic Johnson.
Period.
Period.
And after him? I mean, it's a big gap, it sounds like.
Yeah, I mean, and I would say after him, Kobe. But then immediately it's Kareem and James Worthy. James Worthy made me start watching the Lakers because he was a Gastonia boy and I was a North Carolina guy.
Mm-hmm. You are a double Tar Heel,
yes,
if I have
am.
That right.
That's correct.
Kobe White, after his 1 year as a Tar Heel, was drafted by the Chicago Bulls. When Carolina guys elevate to the NBA, how closely do you follow them or try to follow
I
them?
I watch as many as I can.
Okay.
You know, unfortunately, we've turned out a lot of young ones that hadn't quite stuck. But the ones that stick, like Kobe's going to stick, I love to watch them.
I really don't want to talk about the Lakers, and we're not going to talk very much about the Lakers, but I will say this, because I'm sure you're excited. My wife is excited. My wife, who's a Carolina grad and her whole stinking family went to Carolina. I actually like Carolina. I'm a Syracuse grad. But I was chatting with my wife the other day, and I was like, Danny Green signed a 2-year contract
yes,
with the
did.
Lakers. And I looked at her, and I go, you will not be rooting for Danny Green. Because, again, I'm truly a big Celtics fan. Who's your favorite Carolina player in the NBA right now?
It might be Coby White. Now, think about it, just because I loved how he carried himself at Carolina, and it might be Coby right now.
One more on the NBA, a little bit broader. I don't know if you can answer this one as quickly. Maybe you can. The level of turnover has been incredible. I think I read somewhere this week it was like 30% of all the players from the starting lineups this past year have transitioned in here in less than 2 weeks. Are you generally a supporter of this kind of movement, and I think increased parity in the NBA?
Yes.
Is there a point at which we go, all right, this might not be good for the league, for teams, even for players?
It's interesting because if you had asked me that question, for instance, when LeBron first broke to Miami, mm-hmm. I was not a fan of that because what was happening is you had a couple of super teams being built and it started to look too much like the MLB. And that's the thing I've always hated about baseball is I love baseball as a sport. I love my teams in baseball. But I hate the fact that you know by the beginning of the year that these are the teams that are going to be winners. These are the teams that are going to be fun to watch in the regular season but are never going anywhere. And so that was what I was worried about. Now, with the moves that have happened, how they've happened, with, for instance, Kawhi and Paul going to the Clippers, with the Lakers only being able to get Anthony Davis and LeBron, which is actually pretty surprising. And then the Knicks not being able to get. Yeah, but I mean, think about it.
Kuzma.
Yeah, 10 years ago,
sign Green.
The Lakers tell you that they want you, you sign.
Right.
20 years ago, the Knicks tell you they want you, you sign. And now people's like, no, I'd rather be at the Nets. So that has been exciting for me. I mean, look at Boston. Boston is actually the most blue-collar, mm-hmm. ground-up team of the super teams that are out there right now. I mean, they've actually got a bunch of people who've just been drafted and aren't big names. And so that's amazing to me because, again, 10 years ago, if you were Kevin Garnett, Ray Allen, Paul Pierce, mm-hmm. that's where you wanted to be.
Right. I do think one interesting thing about the Celtics that gets lost a little bit is the fact that historically they have had very, very few major free agent signings.
Oh, yeah.
Al Horford was literally the biggest one when it happened, and Kemba probably supersedes him now. Who's gone first from the Lakers? Let's end on a positive one for me, the Celtics fan. Frank Vogel, head coach, or LeBron James?
Frank Vogel.
He's gone first.
Yeah.
Is he a head coach 3 months from now?
I don't even know if he makes it three months. I mean, the truth is, it's clear that
just
he wasn't.
Hired him.
He was not the guy LeBron was looking for, and so he's not going to be the guy that sticks around if you look at LeBron traditionally.
I'd say I hope he's getting paid well, but I know he's getting paid well.
Of course.
You can find him on Twitter at electreeves, R-E-I-V-E-S. He's the deputy Democratic leader in the North Carolina House, a four-term member from Chatham County. Robert Reeves, thanks for chatting with me on the podcast.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
As always, you can subscribe to the programs on Google Play, iTunes, and Stitcher. Stay up to date with whatever isn't happening with the state budget at our website, wunc.org. For Representative Reeves, I'm Jeff DeBerry. We'll talk to you again soon.